Hi and welcome to Shifters Podcast. Today I don't have only one, but two successful founders with me. First of all, Tony Hsu, the founder and CEO of DoorDash, with a market cap of $26 billion. Is that correct? You probably don't know.
I don't really check our stock price that often, but if that's what it says, then I'm sure it's right.
It's around there. And Mickey Cousy, which is the co-founder and CEO of Wolt, and now head of international at DoorDash.
That's correct.
That's because DoorDash actually bought Wolt. And so I want to start with the question, why did DoorDash buy Wolt and not Wolt buying DoorDash?
I guess it helps that DoorDash is the number one in the States, which is the biggest economy in the world.
Yeah, but I mean, to me, I'm not even sure if that question matters that much as, you know, why we chose to partner with each other, you know, because I think a lot of times when it comes to acquisitions, it becomes a bit of a spreadsheet exercise and you look at the numbers and people can get really excited and people can ask a lot of questions about, you know, making projections from that. But, you know, honestly, what really got the two teams together was just the commonality in how we do things.
Yeah. So what I saw is that you're founded about 1 year apart. So what I was actually looking for is the, you know, starting a business in Europe versus starting a business in the United States in terms of access to capital and stuff like that. So if you were to start, for example, Wolt in the United States, would it have been different?
I don't know. Like every company looks like basically their upbringing and this journey that they've gone through. And I think we have a lot of similarity if you look at DoorDash and Wolt. Like, you know, we both started around, I think DoorDash started in 2013. Wolt was founded in 2014. So around the similar time frame. But like the reality is that we went through very similar journeys. I think it was just different for DoorDash, like being able to ultimately build the leading business in the biggest country in the world. And basically being able to, you know, go head to head with Uber that had like a massive, ride hailing business already in the US and a very big war chest, and DoorDash, you know, still being able to win in the US. And then for Wolt being able to become like a master of doing, like rapid expansion. Like Wolt operates today in 25 different countries. And we had to figure out a very different kind of playbook to succeed. But at the same time, we also had like huge entrenched competitors, like these companies like Just Eat and Delivery Hero and so forth, who had massive restaurant delivery businesses in the countries where we started in. And then, of course, every one of our competitors basically having like 10 times or even 100 times our funding. Yeah. So it's similar journeys in similar timeframes, but having to be, you know, deploy very different strategies to be able to get where we are today.
So when you have like this different access to capital, are there like differences within the companies in terms of what the journeys you've been on? Or are they pretty similar? You mentioned it somewhat.
They're actually quite similar. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, this is where the details become more important than the averages, because I think you're right. At the aggregate, there probably is more venture dollars in the United States than, say, in Europe. But in the story of DoorDash, that actually was not true. DoorDash had a very difficult time fundraising for, you know, the better part of the first 6 years of our company's history. I think a lot of times people look at DoorDash's position today in the market and then kind of tell a very simple, nice story of its, you know, willingness to or ability to access capital. But in, let's see, when DoorDash went public around 2020, DoorDash had the vast majority of its cash balance, you know, in the bank. And that's because in order for DoorDash to have survived, let alone, you know, outcompete in the market, DoorDash really had to win by building a better product. And it's very similar to the Wolt story, where there wasn't a lot of capital. DoorDash couldn't raise funding from the years of 16, 17, 18. But the ability to outcompete really came from building a product that had higher retention and order frequency, which is exactly what happened at Wolt. And maybe the markets are a little bit different in terms of the countries that, you know, the two businesses operated under. But in terms of the capital environment for both companies relative to their peers, we're both the less capitalized companies.
So today, the capital environment is pretty, I don't know how to describe it, but it's not as good as in 2021. And being there, having difficulties with founding, what are your suggestions to founders today in terms of how to get access to capital when it's hard to get capital?
Well, I think it's a great time for founders because it's back to basics. You know, I think when you have moments or periods of excess capital, you know, such as 20, 21, 22, even to some extent, it's very hard to tell who's a winner and who's not. Because everyone kind of looks like they're a winner as they're spending money on growth and giving away free things and, you know, their products at a discount. And when all of that goes away and the rubber meets the road, you now have to see whether you have a product that people find worth paying for. And so it's really back to basics. So I think it's a great time to be a founder now versus in 21 when everyone, you know, looked like a winner, but it was a mirage. It was fake. And I think now, I think founders really get to differentiate themselves by building a better product. And so when you're in this, when you're in the truly founding phase of a company's life, you're in search of product market fit. And I think the best founders with who are able to navigate that search for product market fit, I think they're the ones who are going to be able to separate themselves.
So how do you define product market fit? And how do you know if your product is really, really good?
Well, I mean, it's different for I think consumer products versus, you know, B2B products. And there's many ways in which you can define this. But the best metric on the consumer side tends to be the retention metric, which is very, very hard to fake. You can fake growth. You can, you know, you can fake revenue. You know, the quality of revenue, I think on a lot of companies is now starting to show itself. But it's really hard to fake whether or not someone's going to keep coming back to your product and using it without a discount, without a promotion, on their own accord, and paying you, especially if it's a paid product.
So how was your retention rate in Volt?
Yeah, I mean, we always focused on retention. Like my background is in founded a conference called Slush, which I spent many years building. And then I spent this short amount of time in the gaming industry in a company called Supercell, which, you know, has become successful with games like Clash of Clans and Heyday. And I remember at Supercell, there was a saying that similar to what Tony said, that like, you know, a successful game comes down to three drivers. One is retention. The other driver is virality. Like, how do people recommend or don't recommend the game forward? And the third one is monetization, because ultimately that, you know, makes, you know, your ability to, you know, expand to new markets, market the game and so forth. But the most important driver is retention, because if people don't love something, if people don't come back to something, you can't fix that. You can always like introduce viral components into your games or products, or you can improve monetization if people really like something or love something. So Volt was hyper focused on retention since day one. And that's always been kind of the number one metric that we've looked at as a company. What I love about our industry is that we kind of have to find product market fit again and again and again in every city that we expand to, not even talking about countries. Because people in a city don't really care about whether people in another city, even if it's in the same country, you know, what, you know, product they're using. They care about, you know, do we have the best restaurants, the right grocery stores or shops or stores in the city? Like, they care about, like, if I order now, if I order tomorrow, if I order during a lunch peak or a Friday evening, you know, how good is the experience? What do we promise? Do we stick to that promise? Is it quick? You know, is it an inexpensive service? Like, we have to find that product market fit over and over again.
But how do you balance that with a standardized scalable product? Because that's, you know, it's hard to be both customized and scalable at the same time. So how do you do that?
What we found is that like people are more similar than dissimilar in, you know, everywhere in the world. Like Volt operates today in 25 countries, from like, you know, Nordic countries to Israel, from Germany to Japan. And what we found is that like people are like, you know, mostly quite similar. Like we love convenience. We all need to eat, you know, every day, multiple times a day. There's restaurants everywhere. So ultimately you can build like a product and technology that services is like very different parts of the world, but you're always going to have that, you know, let's call it 20 or 30% local nuance that you have to capture.
Okay.
And that's why our business is so hyper.
So if you don't capture that local nuance, it could be the difference between product market fit and not product market fit. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And that's why we always have like a local team with a very high level of ownership in every country where we operate in.
But you both had problems with getting funded, but you need a product to get to find out if you have product market fit or not. So how did you manage that?
Well, I mean, true retention, doesn't come from spending money. You know, true retention comes from building a product that customers are voluntarily paying for. And so it's not about, you know, getting funded to get the retention. I think if a product, you know, sometimes does require a little bit of marketing to get the flywheel spinning, but if that's the only driver of growth where it's paid marketing, that's usually not a sign of product market.
So how did the DoorDash product look like when you discovered retention? Was it really, I don't know, how can you describe it? Was it manual mostly, or was it, how deep of a product was it?
Well, it's a bit like what Mickey was saying, where you can always improve upon that metric. If you think about, you know, a product like Volt or DoorDash, we're always judged on four things. We're judged on what stores we carry and can bring to you. We're judged on how high quality the delivery is. Were we on time? Was the order accurate? We're judged on how expensive or affordable the service is. We're judged on how well we perform customer support, especially when something goes wrong. And those are the elements that dictate the entire product. I wish it could just be one thing get right. But candidly, it's something that we have to do well. And when, you know, as Mickey was saying, we have to get this right neighborhood by neighborhood, city by city. And so we can have different levels of product market fit based on, you know, how well we score on those dimensions.
So how do you ensure that you get product market fit in different places? You need to like hire pretty much small founders to run the team, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is you have to know what are the metrics that matter, right? Yeah. That actually, we call them the inputs. What are the inputs that actually govern the output, which in this case is the retention and the order frequency. But I think after having a strong point of view on what those are, and then ideally being able to quantify the relationship between the input and the outcome, then you have a formula that can be repeatable. And to your point, if you have great local teams that can deploy that formula, you know, that's really how we can accomplish it. So it's not one thing. I wish it was just, oh, an amazing local team. And maybe that works for a certain, you know, market, but it doesn't really work repeatably across all markets.
So a team with a formula.
A team that can execute with a formula and
then each the product and technology.
Yeah, and then the technology to actually scale it, right? Those are the ingredients. I mean, each one of these are difficult to create in of themselves, but you have to do all of them.
Yeah, so did you at Volt arrive at the same formula? The same four elements that Tony described?
We actually, funnily enough, did. Like, I think ultimately, the most surprising thing about, you know, DoorDash and Volt coming together for me has been how similar, like, the outcomes that we've figured out over the years ultimately are. Like, you know, we've solved similar problems in very different kinds of contexts, ultimately in not so dissimilar ways. I think when it comes to, like, on the Volt side, we've called the formula, like, the playbook. I remember, like, one of our investors was the CEO of Booking.com, from a small company to one of the biggest, like, online services in the world. And he always talked about that you have to build a playbook for expansion. And I used to think about that there's, like, this literate, like, book somewhere that is, like, the playbook of how you do it. But what it actually is, like, it's best practices about, you know, how do you launch a country? You know, how do you make sure you have the product market fit? Like, when can you launch a new city? How many restaurants or stores do you need to have? How many, like, couriers do you need to have online on day one? How do you get the customers? You know, where do you find the first 100 customers, 1,000 customers? Like, this is what, like, the formula or the playbook is all about. Like, you know, how do you do that? And ultimately, if it's the same business, the playbook is going to have also similarity. And then it's going to have differences based on which part of the world you're in.
Interesting. So let's say you both were founders, and then this is going to ask both of you, but let's say you both were starting new companies today. What would be, like, the first steps to get this product launched and get it on into the hands of consumers? Let's say it's a B2C company, to make it easier. Let's start with you, Mick.
Start with the team. Like, I think the number one driver of success, if I look at, like, all the different companies I've had the honor of following over the past, you know, decade and a half, you know, if you look at the ones that succeeded and the ones that didn't, like, ultimately, it just so often only comes down to people. You know, because people need to figure out, like, you know, what is the winning concept here? Like, what is the angle to this market or solving this problem? And it comes down to people. And, like, you know, if you're able to find a product market fit, then it comes down to, you know, how do you build a product? How do you build a technology? What's the playbook? What's the, you know, formula for being able to build something out of it? But, like, ultimately, all of these businesses, especially at the start, are people businesses.
So you should actually use all your energy on finding the right people.
Yes.
Yeah. And how do you find the right people? Tony,
I think this is a tough one. I mean, this might be the hardest piece. You know, finding and composing the right team is different at every stage. I think in the beginning, you want people who are learn-it-alls, you know, who execute with extreme rapid pace and have the humility and flexibility to stay open-minded. Because, you know, to Mickey's point, we should definitely be married to our vision for, you know, the direction we want to take a product or a company, but we can't be married to the details. Those things are going to change, by the way. Even winning formulas don't always stay winning formulas. And so I think, you know, in the beginning, if you can find a group of committed people who want to do things in a similar ways, I don't mean have the same ideas, but have the same standards for excellence, the same beliefs in how we should operate as a team and how we should handle conflicts, I think that's the group that can have the best chance at finding their way towards product market fit.
So pretty much same values.
The same values and across many dimensions, though. You know, I think sometimes values touches on a lot of things that are very true to I think defining moments in a company, but a lot of in the early days or frankly whenever you're searching for product market fit, it's a grind. It's not something, you know, DoorDash early days was doing 5 to 10 orders a day for many months in a row. There's not a lot of discussion around values when you're doing 5 to 10, you know what I mean? And so it's a survival mentality at that point where you're constantly trying to actually find product market fit. And that takes experimentation, that creativity I talked about, the stubbornness to stick to the idea while having, again, the lack of stubbornness or the flexibility to be open about how to get there.
So that's a really, really interesting thing you're mentioning there, because a lot of founders have a lot of ideas and they eventually find out they need to focus. So how to balance the need to expand in terms of ideas with the need to actually focus and focus on one idea? Did you guys try a lot of things?
Well, I mean, I would say the short answer the answer was no. And the reason was because, you know, until we've done a great job solving one job for a customer, we haven't really earned the right to solve the next job. So I think it's great to have a lot of ideas on how to solve the first job. I don't think it's great early on when there's limited resources in every dimension in which you can measure resources, that it's a good idea to kind of spread all over the place, right? And by the way, usually when you are spreading all over the place, it means that you don't have conviction in any one of the ideas.
Did you spread a little bit in Volt?
No, like,
or were you focused on food delivery all the time?
I'm a big believer in focus. Like, you know, when we founded Volt, this was back in 2014, we kind of saw that, you know, the world is going online and more or less like every industry and every human activity is ending up with like an updated version based on, you know, how can the fact that like everyone is connected online all the time make those things better. And with Volt, we kind of started asking ourselves, what is going to happen to, you know, the shopping malls, to like all the different shops and stores and like shopping malls and streets. And like, and we asked, like, how are these, you know, going to become better for consumers, for the businesses themselves because of the world going online? And our hypothesis was that, you know, the restaurant is the biggest local service. People eat every day, you know, so how can we make this better for the fact that people have a phone in their pocket? And we were committed to figuring out a way to, you know, make this industry better for consumers, for merchants. And ultimately, we just found this kind of magical product market fit with delivery. And after that, we just obsessively focused on that for, you know, first basically 5 years of our existence.
But did you know, you knew about DoorDash before you started, right?
No.
No, you didn't, because you were started 1 year before. So you didn't, it's not like, so, you look at DoorDash and, oh, we're going to do the European version.
So I think the important thing to note here is that when we founded Walt and when Tony founded DoorDash, there was no industry. There was no, like, you know, this is a massive opportunity and like we should be doing this. Like, there was, you know, a bunch of companies that had raised some millions of like dollars or euros, you know, trying to figure out different problems. I remember hearing of DoorDash, you know, around the time that we founded Walt for the first time. But for me, like, we were a restaurant company and DoorDash was like a delivery company. That's how I kind of thought about it. And then ultimately we found that for the restaurant, the magical thing was delivery. And I think for delivery, the magical thing was the restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember correctly, Volt started as a pickup app.
Yeah, we started with pickup. Our vision with Volt was that we're going to do pickup, delivery, reservation, discovery, and then we're going to expand to like other local services. Yeah. And then we saw with delivery that, like, hell, this is what people really want.
So do you only, I'm sorry for my ignorance, but do you only do food or do you do other services as well?
We basically deliver everything.
Everything.
Everything inside the city.
Yeah, Norway is one of our newest markets as also Wolt, so it's still early as a market.
So what is everything? Is like a shoe?
Yeah.
Groceries, so, convenience store items, retail shops, flowers, alcohol.
Okay, so do you aim to be like the last meter or last mile within the cities? Is that your or also in the rural areas?
I mean, DoorDash covers like 97% of the U.S. population.
Yeah, we cover. That's exactly right. We cover very high 90s percentage of households, including cities that have fewer than 5,000 people.
Really?
So I don't know if you consider that rural. I don't know. I grew up in a town of 800 people. So again, I don't know your definition of rural or not rural.
I think that's the definition of rural.
Yeah, it's certainly smaller than Oslo. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, if you think about what makes local commerce so great, in any decade that it's ever been studied or measured, it's always the greatest producer of GDP for a city.
Yeah.
Right, all the small, medium, and large shops, whatever they are, flower shops, the barber, the restaurant, the grocery store, the gas station, yeah. all of those businesses combined, they are the vast majority of jobs and economic progress for that city. That's been always true.
Yeah,
and that's true in a rural town, yeah. And that's true in a metropolitan
area. But don't you need a certain amount of density to make it profitable in a sense?
I don't think that's how customers think about things.
Business people think about things.
To give you a sense, like Finland is a country of 5.5 million people. That's our home country. We operate today in around 80 cities in Finland.
Yeah.
And for context, in Finland, there's maybe 5 cities.
Mm.
So we're talking about like really small towns for the most part. Like this kind of model, like if you have the right setup and the right product and the right technology, you can operate in very rural environments.
And this is what I'm saying. You can't get married to ideas, right? And you said something very important. You said, this is the way business people think about something. Every company needs to start by thinking about how customers think. Customers don't care about what business people think, right? Customers care about what's great for customers. And it's our jobs as founders to first start and build a product that customers love and then turn it into a business that actually can make sense. But I think if we start with the idea or the kind of affiliation that there must be a quote-unquote density, to use your words, tied to a certain type of business, that restricts a lot of the imagination possible on what could be possible. And I think this is what I mean by, I think it's okay to be stubborn and hold firm in our vision that we want to build the local commerce company globally, every city, every country, every category. But it's not okay to be married to how we get there.
No.
Or married to what preconceived notions there might be, because the world is always changing. I mean, take for example, when DoorDash was started in the US, the canonical belief was that you should never do logistics. You should just work with restaurants that offer their own delivery. But that was missing 99% of the market. The vast majority of restaurants in the US did not do their own delivery outside of pizza and maybe some Chinese food and things like that. And if we just stuck to that notion and try to make that better, we would have missed the entire point of doing DoorDash.
Yeah. So love the problem, not the solution.
Yes.
Okay, we need to round up. One last question, Peter Thiel question. So what do you believe to be true, but that everyone else will disagree with you in?
I think a lot of people like to move on to the next thing before the previous thing has, had the possibility to become as significant as we believe it to be. Like right now, a lot of people are talking about AI, and I think AI is like probably the most significant thing that we will see in our lifetimes. But the reality is that like the world going online is still very, very early. And if I look at like the, this is not controversial, but if I look at the thing that I believe in, I think, like people don't realize how early it is in like, the world going online. And that's what I'm personally
excited about. Give us a number which puts that in context.
So to give you a sense, like if you look at the US as an example, of the US retail industry, or all of retail in the US, like, around 20 to 30%, high 20s, I believe.
High teens.
It was like high 20s.
It became high 20s during COVID and it's kind of reverted back to the mean trajectory, which is high teens.
So this is one of my favorite.
Less than 20%.
Yeah. Let's call it like somewhere roughly around 20%. This number was basically zero 20 years ago. And now let's imagine what the number is going to be in 20 years or 40 years or 50 years or 100 years.
Yeah.
And now take the fact that like, if you look at Europe as an example, we are not in the 20s even. We're not in the teens. Like, I think we're in like low single digits in most European countries. And I believe like 80% of these industries will end up online. That's how early it is.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Tony, what is your controversial?
I'll give you two. I think one's becoming less controversial, but I'll give you two. I think the first is, you know, I just want to piggyback on what Mickey said about the fact that I think everyone's kind of gotten familiar with e-commerce, and so I think they think, oh, everyone buys things over the internet. But the percentage of a business, local business, that's actually being digitized, you know, part of that is the ordering experience, what Mickey's talking about. But everything from marketing, customer support, analytics, everything that a business has to do, a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of that is actually digitized and using technology today. That is, you know, probably the greatest business model transformation of our time that, you know, very few people talk about. The second thing I'll tell you is that you can build a very profitable business doing last mile. I think very few people believe this. I think more people are believing it now, but I think that this is something that for certainly the past decade that we've been building DoorDash and Volt, that was always the biggest criticism of the industries that we both serve in. But I think that point is becoming more and more, or less and less controversial.
So I have to ask you, sorry, I haven't checked, but are you profitable?
DoorDash has been cash flow positive for a very, very long time. I mean, all the time that we've been public, that answer has been true. Even before we were public, that was true.
Is it like a 90% margin type of cash flow positivity, or is
there are very few businesses that are 90% margin? Mm-hmm. But what I would say is no. This is a business where you do lots of activity. You don't make a lot of money per activity, and so it is a scale business. But once you achieve certain thresholds of scale, it becomes a very profitable exercise.
Okay, last question: just yes or no. Will we see more consolidations within this last mile space? Will more DoorDashes buy Volts? Or maybe.
Yeah, I think the question is, I think the question is, will there be, I think because it's a scale game, the winners are going to become a lot bigger.
Yeah.
And that's what I would say about that.
Okay. What do you say, Mickey?
I mean, let's see. Like right now, if I look at the world, like, you know, it's a pretty different place than it was a few years ago with like war in Ukraine and inflation and like all the economic uncertainty in the world. And I think for companies like us, like, you know, you should just focus on your execution. Whether there's going to be like consolidation or not, like ultimately that's going to be dependent on what kind of decisions different companies make. But I think right now, if I look at our focus is on building the best possible company, serving customers. And, you know, we just expanded to two new countries as DoorDash and Volt. So we're certainly focused on just building up the business. And let's see what happens in the market around us.
Sorry, I need to ask you one more question, Mickey, because both Slush and Supercell are both awesome. I don't know. Slush is not a company, but it still is. Awesome stuff. What helped you being a serial founder when you founded Volt? What was the one thing that helped you being a serial founder?
I don't know. Like, I've always been curious about, like, you know, things that I see in the world around me. Like, I saw that, okay, the world is going online and there's this, like, almost like industrial revolution we're going through right now. And it seemed like Europe was getting left out. And that's, you know, why we started working on Slush. Kind of the thinking was that, hey, we can build these companies out of Europe as well. They don't all need to come from, like, you know, China or the US. And with Walt, the curiosity was that, you know, the world is going to go online one way or another. What is it going to be for the small shops, for the local restaurants and so forth? And, you know, for me, these are exercises of curiosity. You know, first and foremost, of course, you learn a lot about people and about like different best practices and war stories, and you meet investors and, you know, so forth. But ultimately, every company is a journey, and you need to go through that journey.
So there is no one thing?
There's no one thing. Definitely not.
So the company is a journey. All right, guys, thank you very much. I wish you all the best on your second stage journey. So are you? What is the next step? So what will be the next step of DoorDash now in terms of global domination?
Well, I think we're pretty early on our journey globally. But look, I mean, the first decade for DoorDash was really trying to, you know, make a difference in the restaurant industry. And I think we've made some of our mark there. You know, this next decade with both DoorDash and Wolt in all of the markets that we're in is about trying to make a difference in all categories inside of a city. And I think it takes a while before we've earned that right. But it's a really fun privilege and journey to be on.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hei, hvis du likte denne episoden, så abonner på den og gi den gjerne en 5-stjerners rating med dine tanker. Hvis du interessert I temaene vi tar opp på denne podcasten, så anbefaler jeg deg å gå inn på skifter.no. Og hvis du mener vi fortjener det, så kan du gjerne støtte oss ved å abonnere på Skifter. Takk for at du hørte på, så ses vi neste uke.